Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Jason Dickstein. I represent Avia Dynamics. This morning, I'm here to talk to you, and I'd like to begin my discussion with a discussion of the five major procedural problems with the order that is at issue in this case. The first three are related. They are that the administrator, in issuing the order, failed to provide prior notice to Avia Dynamics, failed to provide Avia Dynamics with an opportunity to be heard with respect to the order.
You appeal timely?
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
You appeal timely?
Oh, Your Honor, the order was actually issued on June 22nd. The order was not made available to anyone in the public until it was placed on the Internet on August 27th. Under both NATA versus McCarter, this court's case, and the AmeriCopters versus FAA, a Ninth Circuit case, both have explained that where the administrator fails to provide service or notice of the order to the affected parties, the 60-day period is tolled until such time as they have reasonable notice of the order. In this case, that time period was tolled until they were provided with actual notice in September.
Internet notice can never be adequate?
I'm not sure that we're willing to say that internet notice can never be appropriate. However, under the circumstances of this case, there was no normal reason for my clients to be looking at the internet in light of the fact that this case had actually been closed out over a year before with a letter of closure following a settlement. Therefore, they weren't on notice that they should be looking at the internet. Looking at the internet for unapproved parts notices is not something that manufacturers normally do, and as a consequence, providing this notice, disseminating this notice on the internet really was not calculated to provide my clients with notice of the fact that this order had been issued.
Is your premise that it's inconceivable that there could be a UPN notice following the preceding proceedings?
Actually, my premise is that it is inconceivable that a unapproved parts notice would have been issued without any prior notice and after my client had been told that no further action would be taken in their case because of their settlement.
Is there anything in the record that indicates, isn't this the usual way the FAA does the UPNs? I mean, puts them on the website.
That is the normal way of disseminating them, Your Honor. You're correct. But by the same token, publishing cases in the Federal Reporters is the normal way that the courts publish their decisions, but that doesn't mean that it takes the place of service of the orders. The statutes in Title 49 specifically say that orders must be served, and they even state that orders must be served either by mail.
But those are orders after formal proceedings, right? 46105B. That's talking about a formal proceeding. This is informal adjudication here, and we've never held that in informal adjudication the party needs to be served.
Well, Your Honor, Title V obviously draws a very clear distinction between formal and informal proceedings. And under Title V, 5 U.S.C. 706 suggests that an agency must follow its own guidance, its own laws and regulations. In this case, the Title 49 requirements apply to all orders. Title 49 doesn't draw a formal-informal distinction. And perhaps more importantly, the FAA has actually issued its own regulations. In 14 CFR 13.20, the FAA provides the procedures to be applied to, as the regulation says, all other orders. And it accepts, of course, the orders that are described in other procedural sections of Part 13. 1320 states that before any other order is issued, it must be subject to prior notice. After prior notice, the...
How about this Safe Extensions case where the advisory circular was considered an order under 46110, but not subject to these statutory requirements of notice and comment or proceedings on the record and so forth. In other words, it falls into the vast category of informal adjudications.
Well, I don't believe that in Safe Extensions there was any argument specifically about the failure of service. In Safe Extensions, though, the Safe Extensions Court did specify that they felt that the administrator had flouted the procedures that should be associated with the issuance of an order.
Does the agency call this an order?
The agency has admitted in their pleadings that this is an order.
What pleading?
I'm sorry, in their reply brief.
That this is an order?
Correct.
Is there any case in which a court has reviewed a UPN advisory?
To my knowledge, I do not believe that there is. And actually, Your Honor, I used to be the chairman of the FAA Suspected Unapproved Parts Committee, so I probably would have known about such a case if it had ever come over.
So, I mean, the question to me when I first reviewed this case is, why is this reviewable? It's no different than a policy statement type or interpretive issuance. I mean, why is it reviewable? The mere fact there may be consequences from a non-reviewable action doesn't make it reviewable.
Well, Your Honor, in this case, what we have is an order that has specifically stated that my client, Avia Dynamics, has created unapproved parts.
Your client acknowledged that.
Actually, my client has not necessarily acknowledged that they violated regulations.
Let's assume that's the way I read the record, that there's no confusion on that point whatsoever. I went back and looked at it last night to make sure I was straight on that. Your client acknowledged that.
My client acknowledged that.
That's why your client, I think, thought that it was over with. Fine, I acknowledged it, mea culpa. But what the mea culpa was, yes, okay, and I will do it right from here on in. And then there's this advisory saying, you know, that it's important that people do things right. How does that become a reviewable matter?
Well, Your Honor, first of all, looking at the acknowledgement that you point out, the acknowledgement was made in the context of a settlement. And if you,
That's not the thrust of my question. The thrust of my question is, this is just an advisory. And I can't square this in administrative law with things that we make reviewable. And it's not enough to say to me, but it seemed to have bad consequences. You can't cite me a case. I didn't think there was one, but I wanted to be sure. And you certainly, like you say, you are there. There's no such thing of judicial review of this kind of an advisory. So why should there be now?
Well, Your Honor, Safe Extensions is an analogous case in which the court...
It's not a UPN notice, right?
You're correct, Your Honor.
Okay.
But it is analogous in that it was an advisory circular that this court found what could not stand because of the errors in promulgating it and the failure to provide substantial evidence. And even more so than Safe Extensions...
So then the best you have in the case law is maybe it's reviewable if... In its creation, it's deficient. If the agency fouls up creating this UPN, we, the affected party, ought to be able to challenge that and make them create it correctly? Is that what you're saying?
Well, Your Honor, in addition, orders are defined as anything that has an effect by virtue of having been issued. Before the order was issued, my client could sell parts to air carriers. After the order was issued, because there is other guidance for air carriers and for repair stations that precludes them from purchasing unapproved parts, the UPN actually says that all of the coffee brew trays that are manufactured by my client are unapproved parts and must be quarantined.
Let's go back then. You have to, maybe you need to tell me what it is that you think your client said in response. I thought your client acknowledged that. Should I look for the words and read them to you?
Well, the item that is in the record is the settlement agreement. And in fact, the FAA, for some reason, the FAA's record did not include the first draft of that. In August of 2008, August of 2007, They initially provided a draft that the FAA had asked for as a settlement document.
You're not referring to the root cause analysis and corrective action report, are you, when you're talking about settlement?
Correct, Your Honor, yes.
That's the same thing as the settlement document? Yeah, because at JA 166, as Judge Edwards pointed out, your client writes, coffee maker brew trays were fabricated and shipped with the intention of installation without the benefit of being produced under an FAA-approved production system. Why isn't that a concession?
That was part of a settlement agreement.
Does that make it any less a concession that it was part of a settlement agreement?
Well, Your Honor, my client had raised in the investigation other defenses. They actually had an arrangement that's documented here in the appendix between themselves and the actual design approval holder to manufacture these. They had produced that under a direct ship agreement. And unfortunately, the direct ship agreement predated the guidelines for direct ship agreements by 10 years, and as a consequence, was not written down in the form of direct ship agreements that was described in ARP 9114. Nonetheless, they felt that they had a direct ship agreement that they had been shipping under for approximately 10 years. And in addition, there was a serious question about whether these parts are actually aircraft parts regulated by the FAA. This is something that could have been litigated by my client.
But you didn't.
Correct, Your Honor.
You acknowledged the alleged mistake. I'll call it alleged.
But they acknowledged it in the context of a settlement agreement that is actually represented by the closure letter that's found
in. But does a settlement foreclose the issuance of a UPN?
It should serve to provide for claim preclusion of other orders.
I mean, a settlement will say what it means to say. Does a settlement foreclose the issuance of a UPN?
The settlement does not discuss the UPN.
So
however, the
foreclose.
UPN.
It doesn't. Is the UPN is just this notice about be nice. I don't get it. What's the big deal?
Your Honor, it is more than a notice.
It may have consequences. There are lots of things in life that have consequences that are not necessarily reviewable. Your client acknowledges that I did something that the law prohibits. The agency says so, doesn't take any kind of punitive action. It just says this is an advisory going forward. Make sure we do this right. And now where are we?
Well, Your Honor, the UPN does more than just advise people of something. The UPN specifically defines these parts as unapproved.
They were unapproved.
Your Honor.
Isn't the effect of that you're not going to be able to sell these, right? You're not going to be able to sell these. Isn't this like safe extension in that sense that the practical effect of the FAA action is to foreclose your client's ability to sell these, right?
You're right, Judge Griffin.
And you know the case law in the circuit that mere effect of something like this doesn't make it reviewable.
Your Honor?
Serious fact. I mean, I can think of the cases. I was on one of them, wrote one of them. Serious practical consequences don't necessarily make something reviewable.
Your Honor, there is not a one-to-one correlation between not having a parts manufacturer approval and the parts being unapproved. The term unapproved is defined in the FAA's advisory circular 21-29. And we actually have included in the appendix both the earlier version that
tell
was...
Me, wait, tell, I don't mean to interrupt you, but I think I know where you're going there, and I need another question answered from you. What is it that you think, forget the practical consequences, okay? Forget how the market might or might not react. What is it you think this UPN does to your client that's bad with respect to which you could litigate and win? What is this UPN doing?
It defines the parts as unapproved.
Right.
Had we had an opportunity for a hearing, we would have demonstrated that, in fact, the parts were manufactured under a direct ship authorization. In addition, we would have pointed out that the statute of limitations had run on the ability to issue an order.
You had an opportunity to litigate.
We had no knowledge that a UPN was in the works.
Oh, so you're saying different from the info. This was not an enforcement action. The UPN was not an enforcement action. and all it does was to say, to repeat what your client conceded, that these were unapproved parts. Does it say anything more than that?
Your Honor, I would...
In your view, I'm just trying to understand your theory, because I'm not getting it. There's no enforcement action. That's gone. And you're right. They said, okay, this is over. And all they do is issue a notice saying what your client has acknowledged.
Well, Your Honor, my client acknowledged that they did not have a parts manufacturer approval.
Right.
They have always asserted that they had direct ship authorization. And as a consequence, under AC 2129, these were approved parts. In addition, Your Honor, by defining the parts as unapproved, because of the other standards that the FAA has issued that preclude air carriers and repair stations from purchasing and using unapproved parts, they have effectively established a bar against my client selling any coffee brew tray makers.
That's not true, because this is phrased as a recommendation. It says these parts distributors are encouraged to inspect, and then they don't even say quarantine them. It is recommended the parts be quarantined. So they leave it up to these the buyers, really, to decide. And isn't that an indication that nothing is going to happen if they don't, nothing's going to happen to them if they don't quarantine them?
There is a separate order, Your Honor, Order 8900.1, a copy of which is included in the appendix of guidance. Mm-hmm. And in that order, air carriers are precluded from purchasing unapproved parts. They're required to have a system to prevent them from entering inventory. They are also required to search their system and make sure that they remove all unapproved parts from existing aircraft.
Well, then what do you do with this language? If any of the subject parts are found in existing inventory, it is recommended the parts be quarantined. Are you saying that the other circular requires them to remove them? I don't understand how that fits with the question.
Order 8900.1 does not provide that sort of leeway for air carriers. It requires them to have a system to preclude them from inventory and to remove them from all
aircraft. That's an effect of that. That's not an effect of this UPN.
But this UPN is issued in the context of the existing guidance that precludes air carriers from purchasing it.
And I thought UPNs were advisory. Isn't there an FAA order that says UPNs are advisory?
Well, Your Honor, even if they are advisory, the Safe Extensions Advisory Circular was also advisory, and the Safe Extensions Advisory Circular was deemed to be in order because of its effect. In this case, the key element is not the later language that says that there's to quarantine the parts because of the fact that other guidance requires them to be precluded from inventory. The key element here is the mere fact that they are defined as unapproved, because by defining these parts as unapproved, it links them into the Order 8900.1 preclusions associated with unapproved parts.
Okay. Anything else? No. All right. We'll give you a couple minutes in response.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Himmelfarb?
May it please the Court, Edward Himmelfarb with the Department of Justice. I'd like to address quickly the two jurisdictional issues, the one that we were really pushing in our brief, which is the timeliness question. I'd like to respond quickly also to the question about reviewability, and maybe I should try that one first. We actually, when we looked at this, we saw it as kind of a close question, and we were actually trying to be reasonable about it and not contest that. We thought that the untimeliness of this petition for review seemed so clear to us, we didn't think it was worth getting into this whole new area of unapproved parts notifications and whether they're advisory and whether they satisfy the two requirements of reviewable orders. And I think, if the court thinks that they're not reviewable, then...
Well, no, you're conceded it, right?
We have conceded it, yes, but it's an Article III issue. It's an Article III jurisdiction, so technically you're not bound by our concession. We are conceding it for...
Part of the calculus in whether something is reviewable is what the agency thinks it is that they did. So
yes.
It's not a pure jurisdictional determination of other sorts where we get to look at it and say, end of discussion. What we would do here is look to see in part what you're saying. And if you're saying, well, we think it's more than just advisory and it was in order.
What we said in our brief, Your Honor, is that these advisory notices in appropriate circumstances might be reviewable depending on the facts of the situation. There are obviously other cases with advisory notices where they're not reviewable. For example, AeroSource, the Third Circuit case we cited in our brief. It all depends on the circumstances. We saw this as kind of a close case because of the whole background of the investigation and whether this UPN itself technically caused legal consequences for the company. We thought it was close enough being as part of the entire investigation. And the jurisdictional problem here that seems to me to be quite clear is the untimeliness, because when this UPN was published on August 27th, it gave them 60 days, a flat 60 days under the statute, subject to the reasonable grounds exception.
Maybe I'm missing something. Help me understand, why did the FAA decide to go the route it did? I thought there was a settlement that agreed not to prosecute, and then
yeah,
later,
but Your Honor,
what happened there?
When there's a suspected unapproved part, you start with a suspected unapproved part investigation. There are times when it leads to a possible enforcement investigation. These are basically going on simultaneously. So the enforcement investigation concluded with, I wouldn't call it a settlement, Your Honor, I would call it, they basically admitted that they had an unapproved part.
But the FAA decided not to.
That's right. That closed the enforcement part of the investigation. The suspected unapproved part investigation was not closed by that. And the admission during the course of the enforcement investigation that they actually had an unimproved part, that this coffee brew tray was unapproved, perfectly justifies publishing an unapproved parts notification to the aviation industry so that they're aware that this unapproved part is out there and they can take steps to avoid using it to segregate it and keep it out of use. It's not
Can
appropriate
I ask you
for use.
About that sentence? Because it seems to me if I were reading this and I had inventory that's described, that I should be waiting until there's a conclusive determination about the eligibility for installation. And I thought that had been concluded. Are you saying that even though there was no enforcement proceeding, and even though I thought the SUP, mm-hmm. the SUP, had been settled, that the FAA was going to do something more? Because if I have it in my inventory and I read that, I think, well, I'm just going to wait to see if they are eligible for installation.
Well, I think, Your Honor, I think the way that these notifications work in the industry is that when you get a notification, when you see a notification like this, you do take the steps. I think in this case, that may not have been, I don't know, maybe not 100%.
I mean, is that even true until a conclusive determination can be made about their eligibility for installation? I get the feeling that this thing was drafted a year before or something while you all were still involved in this, and it just didn't come out. It seems so stale.
Because of that language?
Right.
I think that's fairly standard language for an unapproved parts notification.
Then maybe I'm wrong. I thought that part of it was over with. In other words, you weren't going to...
That's correct. That part of it was, in fact, over with.
Which part?
The part of determining whether it was unapproved, so that you really, there really wasn't, even though it suggests that there may be something more, there really wasn't anything more at that point that needed to be done.
It does more than suggest. It says, until a conclusive determination can be made about their eligibility for installation. These buyers could hold that inventory for 10 years waiting for your conclusive determination, which is never coming, right? Which had already come.
Right, and if they take it out and they segregate, they keep it out of use, that's exactly what should be done. Whether or not they are thinking specifically that they have to go back to the FAA and find out.
Are you saying a conclusive determination had already been made?
Yes, it had.
Then why did you say until a conclusive determination?
I think that probably is just sort of standard language that's used in these notifications.
It's standard language to be confusing?
Well, sometimes, no.
It's not true. It's not a true statement. A conclusive determination had not been made, right? I'm confused.
Had been made in this case.
It had been made.
In this particular case, it had been made.
You say it's standard language to say that it had not yet been made.
Well, yes, because a lot of times there's ongoing work being done, which is one of the reasons that we can't possibly make a statement that all of these are reviewable, because a lot of them are non-final, like the parallel one in the Aerosource case.
But you're saying this one was final.
This one was final.
But the UPN didn't say that it was
final. No, it didn't say it was final. No.
How were they to know that it was final?
How was who to know?
Avia. Anyone in the industry, how were they supposed to know with this language that it was final?
It serves as a recommendation for them to take certain action. And that action is not, it doesn't have to wait until it's final. It's supposed to be taken. It should be taken. It's recommended to be taken now. And
even though it's over with. In other words, it seems to me that you either tell them a year before, we're working with Avia and these parts were not approved, so keep them segregated until we work it out. But instead, a year later, you say, use the same exact language, but you've already decided everything you're going to decide, but you achieve the effect you want because they're going to keep them segregated forevermore because they're never going to hear from you again.
Well, I suppose that's correct, Your Honor, but if they had said what you were suggesting they could have said, it would have had the same effect anyway. I think it's basically puts them in the same position, even though maybe it should have been better phrased. As for the timeliness, the publication date, the statute 46110A speaks of the date of issuance of the order. The order was issued by publication on August 27th.
Make it jurisdictional.
I beg your pardon?
It doesn't make it a jurisdictional statute as to which equitable estoppel cannot apply.
Oh, I thought it was basically more or less not disputed that it was a jurisdictional statute. It gives this court jurisdiction, it's a statutory review proceeding.
Right. There are statutory review provisions with respect to which we can apply equitable estoppel.
Well, I think what happened, Your Honor, first thing is you start from a strong presumption that a statutory review proceeding is mandatory and jurisdictional, is not subject to equitable tolling. And even if you thought that...
Start with that presumption. Did you read Justice Ginsburg's opinion on how we decide whether a matter is a statutory provision is jurisdictional or not? The presumption is the other way around. The presumption is if Congress absolutely intends to make it jurisdictional, they have to say it. You have lots of review provisions that may or may not be jurisdictional. It all depends on how they're written.
Aren't
there other courts that are applying equitable estoppel in these cases?
No, I don't think so, Your Honor.
What are they applying?
They're using reasonable grounds, which is within the text of the statute. There are statutes that are jurisdictional. I mean, you take the notice of appeal statute. Notice of appeal, the district court has the authority to issue a 14-day extension. The Supreme Court said if the district court issues an extension that's 17 days instead of 14.
The Supreme Court said in that case, right.
That you can't
that
do it.
That's a jurisdictional provision.
That's right. Even though it contains within it a provision to give you a kind of a limited exemption from the rigid deadline in there, you don't use equitable tolling in that case. And equitable tolling applies generally to statutes.
You don't mean to suggest, do you? Because I really have misunderstood your argument. Do you mean to suggest that any time you see a time limit in a statute with respect to a civil matter, it is jurisdictional?
No, a statute of limitations is not jurisdictional. No, Your Honor.
There are lots of other provisions as well, including the one that Justice Ginsburg wrote about, the case. Saying that there are lots of provisions that are not necessarily jurisdictional. Congress has got to be absolutely clear that it intends for it to be jurisdictional.
But I think there's considerable precedent that this is a jurisdictional statute, and it cabins the jurisdiction of this court, and it prevents these cases from going to district court.
The question is whether or not we can, in this case, the only question is whether we can apply equitable estoppel.
Okay, well, I would say that, Your Honors, I think our position is you can't. However, even if you can, there's nothing here that would justify it, because what happened here was that the company found out from its customer within 11 days of the issuance of this order They sat around and didn't do anything about it and waited till the last minute. October 26th, they finally consulted counsel. Counsel was unavailable, so they filed their petition for review, presumably by overnight delivery, and they filed in the wrong court. So all of these factors do not work toward allowing equitable tolling on a statute, even assuming that there is such a thing in the statute. Okay, if there are no further questions around there.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay. Why don't you take a minute? Why don't you take 1 minute?
1 minute? Your Honors, I did want to respond to what Judge Edwards had raised about equitable tolling. Obviously, equitable tolling was found to be the appropriate remedy in both the NATA versus McCarter and Maricopter's cases. In addition,
did they state those principles? I was trying to recall as I was sitting here. Equitable tolling?
I don't remember if they used the phrase equitable tolling, the phrase equitable estoppel, but they did establish that the 60-day period begins when actual notice is received. Another thing I wanted to point out is that you've drawn the distinction between jurisdictional statutes, and there is an excellent discussion of that in the Federal Circuit's decision in Henderson versus Shinseki, where they discuss the fact that non-tollable jurisdictional statutes are non-tollable because they are actually transferring jurisdiction from one court to another court. And the court from which it is being transferred also needs to know when it's reasonable for them to understand that their case can't be transferred to an appellate court. In this case, because there was no hearing, there was no notice that could have given rise to a hearing, there was no court from which this case is being transferred. That is to say, no administrative law judge ever heard this case before the order was issued by the administrator.
Did you raise equitable tolling in your blue brief?
Yeah, I mean, that's the other problem.
I raised the issue of equitable tolling, and I also cited to both the NATA versus McCarter.
You raised it as such in your opening brief?
Yeah, where?
I mean, we can make the argument for you, but it isn't clear to me you raised it.
Sorry, court's indulgence for one moment. 38 and 41. In my opening brief,
I checked page 38.
Yeah, I believe it's on 38 and on 41. Okay. And we point out that on page 38, that under the Americopters and the NATA, National Air Transport Association versus McCarter cases, deficient service tolls the 60-day period for appealing rules.
Do you know whether they applied the statute, reasonable grounds, or whether they applied equitable tolling? Because you can, under one theory, you could have equitable tolling plus reasonable grounds.
Both of these were 46-110 cases, and I don't think either of the courts distinguished whether equitable tolling was something different from reasonable grounds. I think that
they can be different, because you can have reasonable grounds on top of equitable tolling. Equitable tolling could produce a certain date, and then you could have reasonable grounds which would extend beyond even that date. I mean, that's why I was had the colloquy with government counsel. It would not be a jurisdictional statute in the sense that they're arguing for. But I'm not sure what you're arguing about equitable tolling as opposed to reasonable grounds. Their formulation is it's jurisdictional, and within that jurisdictional framework, you've got to have reasonable grounds. And I guess they read AmeriCorps and the other case to say that's all they had there. You're arguing equitable tolling, and I guess you're arguing reasonable grounds is an additional statutory possibility, I guess.
Well, Your Honor, the statute obviously uses the phrase reasonable grounds, and Americopters and NATA, I believe, equated those reasonable grounds or the remedy for those reasonable grounds to be equitable tolling. And in each of those cases, the reasonable grounds.
So you're saying the facts in those cases provided reasonable grounds. There's no such thing as equitable tolling apart from that.
Again, I don't think that either the McCarter or the NATA court or the AmeriCoppers court.
No, I'm just trying to understand what your argument is.
In each of those cases, they found that reasonable grounds was the failure of notice, but then they limited the remedy for that failure of notice of the order or the service of the order. They limited the remedy to equitable tolling. That is to say that they stated that the only remedy is that you must then file within 60 days after receiving actual notice.
Well, then how do you fit that? You knew on September 7th or 9th or whatever that you had.
And I believe 60
days, and you were 68 days.
Yes, even under the least lenient description, the government admits that this was filed by November 3rd, which, if I remember correctly, was 57 days after receiving notice.
Were you the lawyer who filed it in the Court of Appeals first? Or was that another lawyer?
When I got back to the office, I was out of the office when all of this arose. When I got back to the office, I actually filed duplicates because my client had shared with me the fact that their notice of appeal, I saw that it was filed in the wrong court, and I filed a duplicate in the correct court. In addition, they had been on the phone with the D.C. Court of Appeals, and the clerk had told them that the clerk's office would forward their filing to the correct court over here.
Let me try one more time to make sure I understand your theory. If you win, for whatever reason, you get past the time limit problems, and all your multiple procedural arguments we buy, and you win, what do you get, in your view?
Well, Your Honor, I believe that you cannot remand this case back to the Manufacturing Inspection District Office that issued it, because that office did not have authority to issue the order in the first place. As we've discussed in the brief, the administrator has very carefully delineated.
Tell me what you get.
I believe that the order must be struck down.
What's the judgment we would be writing if you win on all of your procedural claims? You get what from us?
I believe that this court should set aside the unapproved parts notice.
Just set it aside because it's procedurally deficient.
And in addition, because
is that right? Because it's procedurally deficient, set it aside.
Yes, Your Honor.
Is that what you would normally do in a procedurally deficient procedure, as opposed to saying do it right?
Your Honor, first of all, we do believe that it was also lacking in substantial evidence. But if we set aside substantial evidence, ordinarily, if it was only a procedural error and not the substantial evidence claim that we have also made, then remand would be appropriate. The problem here is that if you remand it back to the Manufacturing Inspection District Office that issued it, the Manufacturing Inspection District Office does not have order issuing authority.
Why wouldn't we just remand it to the agency, the party in the suit?
Well, because the agency has never really initiated an action. The agency, under 14 CFR Section 1320, is required to begin any order with notice, an opportunity to be heard, service of the order. None of that was engaged in this case. We never received notice, and in fact, if you were to take the issuance of the order itself as a form of notice of the action, then that notice would have been issued after the statute of limitations had already run.
Anything else? Okay. Thank you.